This is For Advisors by Advisors. I'm your host, Evan J. Mayer, and today we have a very special guest in John Anik.
Oh, bells and whistles and all. Arguably the greatest name of any podcast I've been on, For Advisors by Advisors. When your wife Lauren told me that was the name and the concept behind it, I'm all in. So it's great to be with you, brother.
It's funny, but I've never interviewed somebody that actually does this for a living. And so you're going to sound better than I do, which is even weirder for me, but I'm going to give it my best.
You got a nice bass to your voice, though. I mean, my voice has sort of been honed and crafted over 20 years. I have an identical twin who is probably a full octave below me now at this point from all the damage to my vocal cords. But we're excited to chop it up about something we're very ignorant about.
You have noticed that, like a difference in your voice?
So I don't notice that other people tell me. We do an NFL podcast together called Anik Squared, and a lot of people suggest to us that we can't work together in that capacity because they don't know who's talking if they're not watching it on YouTube. So
really?
His voice, yeah, it's a little bit of an issue actually as we potentially go into season 3, the reality that we do sound too much alike. But no, he's been told by producers that he's a little bit more nasal and his voice is a little bit higher, which I'll take every day.
Yeah, very cool. So for those of you that don't know John or know little of him, John is the lead play-by-play commentator of the UFC. Started with him in 2012, took over the lead spot in 2017 when Mike Greenberg left, correct?
Yep.
And he is also the co-host of the Anik and Florian podcast, which is doing awesome.
We're getting there. We're getting there. It's, I mean, as you well know, it's an interesting business, the podcast game. We started April of 2015. Wanted to start April of 2014. It took me a year to convince my co-host that he could devote a portion of his every Monday to the podcast, because once you start, you got to keep going.
What was your thought when you created that? Now, this is 2015. I'm guessing, like, you knew other podcasts that were out there. You did this for a living. Were you worried that it was going to go against your contract? Did you like have to, when you negotiate contracts, is that something that you have to consistently put in there? Has the UFC ever kind of gone after you and said, you can't be doing this?
So I went to the UFC first in January of 2015, and I humbly asked for them to give me a podcast, and they were not going to do that. And so I launched my own podcast, but I did go to them first. And probably 6 months after we launched our podcast, they launched theirs, UFC Unfiltered, and that's absolutely fine. I'd put our show up against theirs every day of the goddamn week. But when Joe Rogan is my broadcast partner now, but he was not at the time. I had called one show with him in 2012, but I certainly had a friendship with him, and he's the impetus for us getting into the podcast game. But ultimately, I wanted to have an outlet after these big UFC shows to get things off my chest. I'm a mixed martial arts fan, and also just to have an outlet to communicate with fans, to give back to the fans. It'll never be behind a paywall. I've always said that no matter what offer comes our way, you will never have to pay for the Anik and Florian podcast. It'll always be free. But when we did it, even in April of 2015, a lot of people suggested that there were way too many podcasts. What are you doing? And now here we are almost 9 years in and people are creating them every day.
It's interesting you say that, because I would wonder your point of view on things. And my guess is, you have production constantly in your ears telling you what to do, where to break, so there's probably a lot of times where you want to offer your opinion on something and you just can't. Do you feel that during the show?
Absolutely. And I'm not an analyst, right? I'm a play-by-play guy, and there's a pretty big line there, especially in the other sports. Like in pro football, a play happens, the play-by-play guy announces the whole play, and then the analyst has a bunch of real estate to assess what just happened. But my agent, way back in the day, was like, dude, you have all these strong opinions, opinion pays, you should be in the opinion business. Sports radio at the time was moving towards solo acts. Colin Cowherd was a mentor of mine. I used to do updates on his show at ESPN Radio. And I was just like, I could never be as good as that guy doing a solo show. I always wanted to co-host alongside. So I gravitate sort of away from sports radio because I wanted to be in a more Pat McAfee show type setting with a bunch of people talking at each other. But definitely it gives me a place to voice my opinions, and I just have to walk right up to that line but not cross it.
Yeah, interesting. So you worked with Colin?
Yeah, for a long time. And
love him. Yeah. I don't like, I he's not a Dolphin guy. No praise for Tua, but was it interesting working with him?
Yeah, I mean, seeing somebody that talented and just the ability to, I'm on the other side of the glass from this guy, and to watch him for 3 hours just master pausing after his thought instead of using a verbal crutch like I might use, like, or just to be able to pause on national radio for maybe 5 seconds, just total master of his craft, just complete command of that medium. And I had hosted sports radio shows in Boston. I hosted on ESPN Radio, But I think I only did one solo show in my entire time at ESPN Radio, and that was enough for me to know that I did not want to be sitting in that studio by myself.
Let's piggyback on that. Tell us a little bit about how you got started. I mean, I'm guessing at 13 years old, you weren't talking into a fake mic. Maybe you were.
No.
But how did it go? How did it start? I saw you got a degree in political journalism. Where were you headed? And tell us your life over the last 25 years.
Well, part of the reason I got into sports broadcasting was because I didn't think I could pass the GMAT to go get an MBA. And I certainly couldn't pass the LSAT to become a lawyer. So I think I was pretty good at figuring out at a young age what my strengths and weaknesses were. But I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, in and around the Metro West Pocket, rabid sports town. So I knew, thankfully, from the time I was 15, 16 years old, that I wanted to work in sports. So I was trying to become a columnist for the Boston Globe. I was trying to become a sports writer and ended up working for the Metro West Daily News out of college in Framingham, Massachusetts. And my writing was clean, but it was never particularly special. And I was running into a lot of print journalists that were really talented. But I felt like when we would get into an argument in the sports room, I could carry my own weight. So my goal sort of gravitated towards radio. I did have a 4-year degree from Gettysburg College in political journalism, but I needed to go back to school to get career training. I didn't get a master's. I went to the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, which afforded me the opportunity to get an internship at 1510 The Zone, which was the sporting news radio affiliate in Boston. That allowed me to get on the air. And I knew if I could get that internship, I could start doing updates at some point 6 months later. And once I got on the air, I was able to sort of parlay one thing into the other. But I never was a martial artist, right? I certainly wanted to be the voice of the Boston Red Sox or the Celtics or the Patriots. I didn't ever envision that I would be a combat sports guy, but here we are.
And your big break came with ESPN. Did ESPN hear you on the radio, or how did that work out?
It's a good question. A lot of broadcast journalists, aspiring broadcast journalists, find yourselves in this position where you're sending out hundreds of demo tapes. And I couldn't get any feelers in Montana or New Mexico, but I got a call back from the ESPN Radio National Network in Bristol, Connecticut. I sent them my stuff. And I went down there, I auditioned, and I started as a sports center anchor on ESPN Radio. A couple of years later, they were auditioning radio talent for TV. Definitely did not want to do TV. I'd prefer to be 175 pounds and nobody see my face. But I took that interview and that audition. I eventually started working in a television capacity for ESPN.com. And then the big break, I guess, came in 2008. They were launching an MMA show called ESPN MMA Live that later migrated to ESPN2. And because I had hosted a boxing show for 3 years in Boston, I was one of three guys at ESPN at the time. So the late Stuart Scott, Brian Kenny, and myself were the only guys really there who had anything resembling a combat sports background. Start hosting MMA Live in 2008. All the while, I'm trying to call college football games for ESPN, but I'm not getting any opportunities. I'm getting like one game a season.
Yeah.
Not going to get any better. So in 2011, I was covering a UFC pay-per-view for ESPN in New Jersey, and one of the UFC executives approached me, said, "We'd like to bring you on. We're doubling our schedule from 20 to 40 live events." And they bought out the last 2 months of my contract in 2011. I moved to Vegas, and we're 13 years in.
That's amazing. So with ESPN, as you're kind of going through this, now you grew up in an era where fighting was boxing, like Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis and Evander Holyfield and all these great boxers, and UFC wasn't quite out yet. When did it first catch your eye, mixed martial arts? And when did you know that? And forget knowing, because my guess is that you were good at what you did. People liked you and UFC brought you aboard and you just got even better and better. But what sparked your interest in UFC?
So I don't admit this all that publicly, but I was reluctant at first. As a boxing radio journalist, you see this mixed martial arts avalanche coming, and I wanted to give it the Heisman. I didn't have an appreciation for the wrestling nor the grappling. My boxing radio co-host fucking hated it. So in 2007, we got invited by boxing promoter Gary Shaw to cover Elite XC1. He had launched an MMA promotion and he wanted to bring attention to it. So he paid for a bunch of the boxing media to come cover this event. I did so reluctantly.
So it was your first time, like, yeah.
In 2007 in South Haven, Mississippi, I'm like, what am I doing here? Yeah. But then I saw the live event and I ingested everything that MMA had to offer in a live event setting. And I don't want to suggest that I was hooked immediately, but it opened my eyes. And I thought to myself, this sport has a lot more to offer than boxing. It's so much more exciting. The players are more exciting. And about a year later, I was working in a full-time MMA capacity doing ESPN MMA Live and called my first MMA fight in 2009. And I guess that's when I really stopped thinking about American football, because when I got hired to do Bellator 1 in 2009, I was so nervous. I felt like they had hired the wrong guy. I am not a martial artist. I don't train in jiu-jitsu. I have, reluctantly, And you just find that when you're in a live broadcast setting, you just play to your strengths. And it just was really natural for me. And I felt like I could do that for the rest of my life.
When did you know you had it? Meaning like you started with UFC in 2012. When did you go, I know that move, and you were able to like not mess it up? Like when did you feel that confident in your ability to call the UFC and not stumble over maybe something you weren't, that was very technical that you didn't understand?
I would probably say about 2 or 3 years in, but I would add that it's really a constant evolution. If there's something that transpires on the ground and I'm in doubt as to whether or not it's a Bravo choke or an Anaconda, I'll just say, Evan Mayer by submission, right? I don't care, right? Like that's staying in my lane. And then Joe Rogan can say, yeah, it was a Bravo choke or whatever. So I'm still of a mentality
you still do that to, this
to
day?
Stay in my lane. And you can be sure that when the fight hits the ground, Dana White is not looking for jujitsu analytics from his play-by-play guys.
Yeah, so that makes life easy. I never thought about it in those terms. So Vegas. So you're in Vegas, City of Sin. Now, you're married at the time?
So yeah, I got married in Boston, but I got married, I met a girl from Connecticut, and a few months after we had our first child, we moved to Las Vegas. And I think for a lot of people who go east to west, you never want to come back. I mean, you're a golfer, you appreciate the sun. So Florida's pretty good if you have to be on this coast. But when I went west, I never planned to come back. But my wife just didn't want to stay out there. And I can understand educationally why she didn't want to raise our kids in Nevada. I say that with all due respect, but the numbers are the numbers.
And you moved to Florida when?
So December of 2014.
And did you feel like that decision was going to hurt you with the UFC a little bit, or that it wouldn't affect you?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a few years later when they launched a gambling show and I didn't get that show, I was sort of told in no uncertain terms, well, you want to move back to Vegas, you can host UFC on the line. So yeah, I think professionally maybe it hurt me in some capacities, but it was also nice to not be underneath their nose all the time, right? The Halloween costume contest rolls around and they need an MC and I'm down the road, right? So I think it worked both ways. But we had said to the UFC, we want to live in Connecticut was our number one choice, New York number two, Massachusetts three, Florida four. And due to the corporate tax structure in the states of Nevada and Florida seemed to be the best fit if I was going to stay a full-time employee. Things have changed now. The company now is owned by Endeavor, so I can live wherever they have business set up. So if I wanted to go to New York now, I could, but I like that yellow orb in the sky.
Yeah, so. No. Once you live in Florida, it's very hard to go anywhere else. Yeah. You don't understand unless you live here, right? Right. So talk a little bit about 2017. That's a very pivotal year in your career. You're obviously known, you're doing the UFC events and Mike Greenberg leaves. How do you find that out? And now you're taking the lead role. What was that emotion like?
Well, you're giving me chills because I will never forget where I was when I found out that the company was moving on from Mike and giving me a shot. Because with total respect to my predecessor, I never would have left ESPN. If I didn't think I could ascend to that number one seat and call fights with Joe Rogan, I wouldn't have done it. At the time, the UFC was rumored to be going to G4, like the G4 gaming network, right? But I just knew if I could attach myself to the UFC, I could build myself up. So they pulled me aside at the TV trucks because I was calling a fight on a Friday night and they had a pay-per-view Saturday. And they said, hey, we're moving on from Mike Goldberg. Come January of 2017, you're going to be the pay-per-view guy. And I just like dropped.
And they gave you how much notice was that?
About a month, okay. You know, but I had been calling fights. I just hadn't been calling the title fights, but I felt like they built me, they developed me almost like a AAA player. So I had done 20 shows in Brazil in all of these challenging broadcasting climates and conditions in these rat infested venues with no air conditioning, right? So I felt like I had mastered sort of the, not to call them bottom feeders, but the bottom of the roster so that when I was elevated, I was ready to call those big fights. But I was pretty nervous going into UFC 208 in Brooklyn, New York in January or February of 2017. I remember that being a particularly nerve-wracking van ride to the arena, and Daniel Cormier was trying to talk me up and get me out of my own head.
Now, so that was 208, and now we're entering 299.
Yeah.
So basically, in essence, a third of the time you've been the lead guy. I don't know if you thought about that yet, but about a third of UFC history, you've called those fights, or at least a majority of those fights, or at least been the lead guy on those fights. Has your preparation changed at all? Do you still get nervous when you go on there? My guess is there's always a nervous tension and anybody that's goes on air, because I still to this day when I talk in front of people, and again I don't talk in front of as many people as you do, but I always have that little bit in there.
Sure.
Do you still have that?
So most of my nerves and my anxiety is in the preparation. So the Fridays before pay-per-views, sort of a heightened anxious state. Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there are some butterflies or nerves, the good kind of nerves, when I'm about to call fights. But as soon as you crack a mic and that first prelim starts, any of that stuff dissipates pretty quickly. But yeah, I think it's healthy. Sometimes when I'm up top working the desk and not calling fights, I wish I could channel some of those nerves because I think they can be performance enhancers. I don't think that'll ever go away. I think anybody who's been on stage can relate to that. But dude, preparing for one of these shows, and I say it with all due respect to the pro football announcers who work very hard on their charts, but I might have 30 fighters. So there's always more you can be doing. So I have a lot of anxiety when it comes to being optimally prepared on 30 fighters on a given Saturday night.
And do you have like a one producer, two or three that are like constantly feeding you the line, like I guess the stuff that you've pre-prepped fight for to be ready for those moments?
So very rarely. I mean, sometimes they'll get in our ear and say, hey, that was the seventh arm triangle in UFC history. Or they'll say something that they think might serve as connective tissue. Or they'll say, oh, that happened in this fight. And that may go to all three of us. That may just go to me. But for the most part, the rule for a producer in my ear is 5 words or 5 seconds. If you can't get the message to me in 5 words or 5 seconds, you got to shut it down because I'm calling a fight and something could play out. And early on, I would say to my producers after the show, hey, man, I'm sorry I didn't go. And there's never any pressure to use what comes into our ears. But yeah, as far as my preparation, it's really the same since Bellator 1 in 2009. I mean, there's more of it, but my system of handwriting my own cards hasn't changed in 15 years.
Now, Joe Rogan has a podcast. It's obviously quite popular, as we all know. And he talks about you now a lot. Maybe once every month, he'll go, John Anik is the greatest play-by-play guy in UFC history. And to hear that from a guy like him, who you work not only side-by-side with, but he means it when he says it, how does that make you feel? Like knowing that like 10 years ago, you kind of were the newbie guy in Sure. the business, and now you're the guy.
No, I mean, his words ring true with so many people, and so many people take his words at gospel that I have people calling me the GOAT all the time, and I'm really feel like I'm in the middle of my career. And I get criticized a lot for being suggestive of certain fighters as being the greatest bantamweight of all time when their careers are incomplete. So it's super flattering, especially coming from him. I mean, he's the ultimate source, right? You can imagine what his words have done in terms of establishing goodwill for me with the UFC executives or Dana White. I mean, it's absolutely enormous. My boss, Craig Borsari, listens to every word of the Joe Rogan Experience, so he hears that a lot. And Joe watches more combat sports than I do, right? So he's comparing me to boxing and MMA announcers that are out there. So it's very flattering, but I just sort of have to keep my head down and really try not to think about that, because if your boss is Dana White, you know that this job could go away pretty quick.
Could go on a blackjack table bet.
Right, exactly.
You never know. So you've hit that precipice. What's it like on a stardom basis? Because Joe Rogan, I remember watching him on, was it News Radio? I think yeah. was the show. And then you saw him on Fear Factor a little bit. And then I just started listening to him on his podcast probably 3 or 4 years ago. And he's turned into this guy that every year is just evolving and evolving. And now he's probably more famous than most of the fighters he covers.
All.
When you walk into these arenas, is it like mayhem? Is security everywhere? Like, is it a little out of body experience?
I'd imagine he spends a couple million on personal security every year. He has 2 security officers that are not UFC people that are with him at all times. And it is insane watching him walk into a UFC arena. The adoration that these people have for him is simply insane. And he's earned every bit of it. He was the guy that I put on a pedestal before I was doing this. I just gave him a stuffed goat for Valentine's Day because he's actually the goat. So yeah, it's crazy to see his star power. The one thing that's tough about it is just, he's so high profile that it makes certain things just a tricky navigation. It's not like I can just invite him to dinner in Miami. It's got to be a private room and everything else. And everybody wants a piece of him all the time. But it's obviously a tremendous honor to be able to work with him on these domestic pay-per-views. And I've said he's going to outlast me. Like, people think he's got 1 foot out the door because of this Spotify.
No, he loves it.
I mean, it's the greatest sporting event in the world, in our humble opinions, and he's got a front row seat. He essentially invented the medium as far as MMA analytics, so I think he's going to be there forever.
Again, with Dana White approving, as we always say. I got to talk a little bit about the political environment. So we're in an election year, and UFC, funny enough, became political a little bit over the last 4 or 5 years. And obviously, let's not hide the elephant in the room. Dana White's been very supportive of Donald Trump and calls him a good personal friend. And he comes out to these events now. And the events, from what I see on video, are like, oh my God, it's like mayhem. And then I see a video of you like going up to shake his hand. What is that experience like with a guy like Trump kind of coming in, and the cultivation of an arena? Is it really that boisterous? Is it just the videos we're getting?
No, it's that boisterous. And I would suggest that his public approval rating has gone up, because the first time we trotted him out there, I don't know that he did this walkout with Kid Rock and Tucker Carlson necessarily, but it was mixed. And now it seems like it's overwhelming approval in all these arenas. But I would take it a step further as far as his friendship with Dana White. They're like really close, and they did a lot of things for each other, especially Trump for Dana way back in the day. But as far as I'm concerned, the first time I met him, he was like, you guys do a great job. I watch you guys all of the time. Like, I get the sense that he's watching our small UFC fight nights. I think he went to 4 or 5 live events in 2023. It almost makes me think he's fucking betting on these things, honestly, because those are, when it's a former president, a president of the United States saying, hi, I sit home and watch you guys all the time on Saturday night. That's the foundation of my relationship with this guy. So yeah, even within my own family, there are people that absolutely loathe the guy, people who absolutely love him. And no matter where I stand politically, I guess I just take him for who he is, tremendously supportive to our broadcast team and to my boss. And I just think he's a good man at his
core. Obviously know when he's coming, right? You have to announce him and kind of prepare for it, correct?
And when I'm doing my pay-per-view open, right, I can just tell you, like, the Secret Service gets precedence in terms of that space, right? I am a distant second thought when it comes to where are they going to set me up for my opening on camera.
Is that a little weird?
I'll take it every day of the week. I want him in the building.
Creates energy.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I will say too, like, when the fights are going on, the guy is, it makes me think he's betting on it, because he's totally locked in. Sometimes he even puts the cans on to listen to us. Like, he's there, believe it or not, for the fights.
And the interesting part about it too is, any other professional sport, you could never talk about him. It'd be like you're the absolute enemy. In that sport, if you're a fighter and you're like a Trump guy, the fans love you. Like it's a complete almost 360 to what you see in I'll call it the big media approach.
And it makes me wonder how our left-leaning liberal fighters really feel about the warm embrace, almost leaning into it, even if the foundation of it is just Dana White's friendship with Donald Trump. I mean, you got Dana White speaking at the RNC. I mean, it's really a relationship with a lot of depth. But sometimes I do wonder about the 40% of the roster or so that can't stand the guy and feels like he doesn't like certain groups of people or whatever it is that their beef is. But it's wild, man, having him there. And we get excited, certainly, when we get the email like, hey, 45 is going to be there.
Yeah. Very cool. Talk about unwinding. Now, you leave a fight, you're all hyped up. My adrenaline, like, if I have a long day and I'm seeing 6 clients, funny enough, it takes me 4 or 5 hours just to kind of calm down.
Right.
How do you calm down that night? And then how many days does it take? I mean, at this point, my guess is it doesn't take you that long to calm down. Maybe that night it does. Maybe within 2 days, you're probably okay. What's that experience like?
So it's very similar to yours. Sometimes it can depend on the night. I mean, we just finished UFC 298 in Anaheim, California, and we had our long reigning featherweight champion, Alexander Volkanovski, get knocked out cold in round 2 by this 27-year-old Spaniard, Ilia Topuria. When something like that happens, I can't shut my brain off at all. So oftentimes I'm on the first flight out. Sometimes I go straight to the airport and fly out on a red eye, but usually I stay up all night and sleep a little bit on the plane. Sundays at home with the family are hell. And then
so you're 100% on a plane after the fight. You're never staying the night.
Very rarely. I might sleep, like in Anaheim, I slept for 90 minutes because I just couldn't keep my eyes open. But the goal is always to stay up all night and get on the plane, because you feel worse when you sleep 90 minutes. So generally speaking, I can't shut my brain off. The other thing too is I'm drinking some sort of caffeinated beverage or energy drink right up until 11:30, 12 o'clock. So yeah, there's no shutting my brain down. Sometimes when the pay-per-view is lackluster or I have a big obligation on Sunday or Monday, I'll really try to get in bed. Like, I went straight from Anaheim to Boston to shoot a DraftKings commercial. So I was sort of thinking, oh, if you can get 2 hours here, it'd probably be good for you. But also too, is like, there's no happier man than me when a pay-per-view is done, right? And that's my reality 13 or 14 times a year. So I think there's elation for you. You get done with 6 clients. For me, I get done with a pay-per-view and you want to have a Jack and Coke and decompress.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, for sure. The podcast. There's a passion, there's the pay, and there's the passion. I think you have both on both now, but the podcast is obviously growing, and it's growing significantly from where it was two, three, four years ago. Talk about your evolution into podcasting. When you first did it, were you like, hey, I'm just going to do this for fun and kind of see where this goes? And then did it just start kind of tumbling from there?
Yeah, I mean, we were in the red for 6 or 7 years, but we just felt like if we consistently stayed at it and the content was good, that everything else would take care of itself. And I think the challenge was maybe underpaying a producer or underpaying Ray Longo, who is the coach on our show every week. Those were some of the fiscal challenges that we dealt with. But Kenny Florian, who is my co-host, 3 times he challenged for the UFC title, never won it, but he was committed. And once he was committed, I knew we could do it every Monday. And I think that's the big key to our success, is that literally in 9 years, we have done at least 48 or 50 shows without missing a single
week. Was he your first guy to go to? Was he the guy you wanted?
Yeah, just in terms of, and he was one of my broadcast partners at the time. He's no longer calling fights for the UFC. He works for the PFL now, which has been a little bit of a challenging navigation. But yeah, he was my first choice, to be sure. Ray Longo was my first choice as the coach. We have had one change in producers in 9 years, but that's it. But it can be tricky to bring in money consistently. And we finally got a licensing deal with DraftKings a couple of years ago, and that has really helped the show take.
What does that look like?
Well, they get full-length episodes on their YouTube channel, and that's a big thing for us to give away, because we were building the Anakin Florian podcast YouTube channel, which that revenue goes directly into our Bank of America checking account. Right now, we give rights in totality to the DraftKings YouTube channel, and we are their highest-ranked show, and we drive their YouTube channel, and they reap all the advertising dollars as well, but they pay us a flat fee that allows me to pay my staff. But we've continued to invest in the business, right? $15,000 on a home studio this year. We just paid 2 20-year-olds $7,000 for 3 months to handle our social media, right? So we're constantly trying to take it to the next level. And even though merchandise isn't necessarily a big cash maker, it's marketing. It allows for connectivity with the fans. So we're just trying to now build it more like a business. We brought my twin brother on to be the business manager of Anakin Florian LLC. And I have a lot of ignorant areas. I have a lot of weaknesses as a person, and I'm just trying to find people that can shore those up for us.
Excellent. Well, it's a journey. It's fun, and it allows you to express yourself. And I think probably being a play-by-play announcer, like in this day and age where it's all about expression, this is a great outlet for you. So we wish you nothing but success.
Well, thank you, man. It's great to be on with you and chop it up in this capacity. You're jogging my memory a little bit when I think about just where I was in December of 2016, just getting ready to call this small fight night, probably wondering if I'm ever going to get that promotion. And then you just never know when it's going to come, because those guys were institutions, right? Goldie and Rogan. And you just start to wonder, like, did I get off the wrong horse leaving ESPN in my prime? But I appreciate you.
Sometimes it's hard work, and sometimes it's talent, and sometimes it's a bit of both.
Yeah. And luck.
Luck never hurts. John, thanks for joining us today.
My man, thank you.
Hope everybody enjoyed today's podcast, and we look forward to seeing you on the next one.